In the matter of Janelle Goff versus Folk Management Corp., Sasha Robinson, and Tijuana Johnson versus Mall Chevrolet, may we please have appearances? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Ricola.
If I could, I would like to reserve 5 minutes rebuttal, two to address the plaintiff and three for the amicus.
Okay.
We're here today to ask this court to overturn the appellate division's decision. We think that the court erred in four ways. First, this arbitration agreement contains all of the necessary language that this court and the appellate division has said needed to be in an arbitration agreement for it to be enforceable. It also has a clear and conspicuous delegation clause. And the delegation clause sent the issue about the validity of the contract, negotiations relating to the contract, to the arbitrator. I respectfully submit that the appellate division completely ignored the delegation clause in this case. The appellate division also held that these contracts were canceled, and because they were canceled, the arbitration agreement was canceled with it. I respectfully submit to the court the contracts weren't canceled. They were conditional contracts. The condition wasn't met, so other performance was required. For example, because financing wasn't met, the performance, instead of paying, was that the plaintiff returned the car. In addition, the United States Supreme Court in Nodal versus local number 358 Bakery, and it's 430 U.S. 243, held that if a contract that has an arbitration agreement is canceled, the arbitration agreement is not canceled unless that arbitration agreement expressly says within it that the arbitration agreement is canceled if the contract is canceled. This arbitration agreement did not say that. In fact, what the appellate division did was turn the United States Supreme Court's ruling on its head and said, because the arbitration agreement did not say that it survived cancellation of the contract, it was canceled. It's the exact opposite of what the United States Supreme Court has held. Number three, the court held that because the plaintiffs claimed under NJSA 56-8-2.22 that they did not receive a copy of the arbitration agreement, that nullifies the entire contract. The arbitration agreement's not enforceable, the whole contract's not enforceable. That section, that statute, is part of the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act. The delegation clause in the arbitration agreement expressly says claims for violations under the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act go to the arbitrator. That claim should go to the arbitrator. In addition, the appellate division failed to do the analysis of whether or not there was an ascertainable loss causally related to the alleged violation. That's a requirement this court has made, and it's found in the statute under NJSA 56-8-19. In addition, we believe that the appellate division's holding that Goudati, requiring a limited discovery and a factual hearing as to the plaintiff's claim of fraudulent inducement, because there were factual issues, again was wrong. The facts in this case are distinguishable from Goudati. In Goudati, the plaintiff did not sign the arbitration agreement. In this case, both plaintiffs clearly admit they signed the arbitration agreement. In Goudati, there was a question about when the plaintiff saw the arbitration agreement. There's no question in this case. They signed it along with the other documents. In addition, in Goudati, there was not a delegation clause. In this case, there's a delegation clause. looking specifically at the language in this arbitration agreement. It's not hidden. It's a separate page document, very large document. It has bold capital letters at the top. It says, read this arbitration agreement carefully. It limits certain of your rights, including your right to maintain a court action. And that language is repeated, again, in bold capital letters, right above the plaintiff's signature. Twice within this agreement, it also tells the plaintiffs, the consumers, that they're giving up their right to have a jury trial. They're waiving that right. It doesn't say it just once. It says it in the first paragraph, and then there's even a second section with capital letters. Waiver right to jury trial. You and we expressly waive all right to pursue any legal action to seek damages or any other remedies in a court of law, including the right to a jury trial. This court has said that is enough to show mutual assent to agree to arbitrate. Then we have the delegation clause. And by the way, the plaintiffs never attacked the arbitration agreement. They never attacked the delegation clause. The plaintiff's entire claim is, we were told something different than what this contract says. Their claim boils down to a claim for fraudulent inducement. And it boils down to the negotiations. The delegation clause says, the arbitrator will hear whether the claim or dispute must be arbitrated, the validity of this arbitration agreement, any negotiations between you and us, any claims of fraud, including fraud in the inducement of this or any other agreement, and claims under the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act. The United States Supreme Court was very clear in Rent-A-Center. There's two types of challenges to an agreement. One, the first type, is directly to the arbitration agreement. You don't have that in this case. The court said only when there is an attack on the arbitration agreement itself and the delegation clause will the court decide whether the parties go to arbitration. The second type of challenge is a challenge that we have in this case. It's a challenge to the contract as a whole. When I signed the documents, they told me the document said something different than what they actually said. That's not a mutual assent issue. That's a claim of fraudulent inducement. And Rent-A-Center even identified fraudulent inducement as a claim, and when the fraudulent inducement is as to the whole contract, the United States Supreme Court said in Rent-A-Center, those claims of fraudulent inducement for the whole contract go to the arbitrator. The arbitrator decides it, not the courts. And the Supreme Court recently in Schlein reiterated that when there's a delegation clause, as long as on its face there's a valid arbitration agreement, and in this case even the appellate division agreed, on its face there's a valid arbitration agreement here, the claims go to the arbitrator. I think this court said the same thing in Morgan versus Sanford Brown. This court said, as long as there is a clear and conspicuous delegation clause, it goes to the arbitrator. The appellate division completely ignored all that case law.
How do you read Rent-A-Center if there is a dispute about whether a delegation clause is clear? Does Rent-A-Center require that that dispute go to the arbitrator?
No. I think it's up to the court to determine whether it's clear and conspicuous. But first, the plaintiff has to challenge it. And in this case, the plaintiff did not challenge it.
And the holding of Rent-A-Center, or the majority in Rent-A-Center, found there has to be a specific challenge to the delegation clause.
Correct.
So one of the arguments that's being made by your adversaries, and the one that the appellate division seemed to latch onto, was that the violation of 56.8-2.22, the failure to give a copy of the contract, nullified everything. Nullified the contract, the delegation clause, the arbitration clause.
I think they're wrong. Because there's nothing in the statute that says that. If the legislature wanted that to be the remedy, The legislator would have put that in the
statute. So the there's nothing in the statute that guides us to the remedy.
That's
so,
number one.
So it's up to the court now to determine what the remedy is, no?
Well, no, because I think the legislature gave you a remedy, and it can be found in 56 8-19, because 56 8-2.22 is part of the Consumer Fraud Act.
Aren't there equitable remedies under the CFA?
There are only equitable remedies if the conditions of an ascertainable loss causally related to the violation are found, and that's just not the case here. There's no allegation of any ascertainable loss causally related to not getting a copy of the contract.
Can you speak to Ms. Johnson's role in all of this? She wakes up one morning, she's the owner of a car, and doesn't sign any documents, doesn't enter into any arbitration agreement, doesn't review it, doesn't discuss it, and the next thing she's told is if you've got a grievance, it has to go to an arbitrator, you've lost the right to a jury trial.
Well, we did not take that position, Your Honor. In fact, on appeal, we said that the court was wrong to send Ms. Johnson to arbitration because she did not sign the arbitration agreement.
So that question's not before us?
What the question that...
I thought there was a standing question.
That was a well, the standing question that we argued was she had no ascertainable loss.
Right. I thought that question was beyond, was behind us. Is the question as to whether she goes to arbitration also not in front of us?
I believe so. Yeah, we haven't raised that issue. We understand she didn't sign the arbitration agreement.
I couldn't hear what you said.
We understand she did not sign the arbitration agreement. We're not attempting to enforce the arbitration agreement against her.
So under
you
the...
Argue it,
go ahead, Justice Fernandez.
You don't have to answer this, I think, but will you argue at the trial court that she's not entitled to consumer fraud action because she did not sign the contract?
Before the trial court, we argued she did not have standing because she could show no ascertainable loss. She never saw the document, so she couldn't have a plain language claim. So we just said she didn't
but
have...
But it's on the merits, not on the merit. On a standing issue, actually.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you're relying on some U.S. Supreme Court cases that seem to distinguish between challenges to the agreement as a whole versus challenges specifically to the arbitration clause.
Correct.
And you put in that category Rent-A-Center, Buckeye, and some others. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you believe that the appellate division decision then resulted in an extension of Ghiodati? Because in Ghiodati, there was, as the court found, a genuine issue of material fact regarding whether the plaintiff had actually received the document containing the arbitration agreement. So there was a dispute directly dealing with the arbitration agreement, unlike here, where everything is focused on an argument based upon, is there an agreement as a whole?
Correct.
That's valid?
Yes. And I think the appellate division incorrectly interpreted Ghiodati. Not, it may have been an improper extension, but I think it was also an interpretation problem. Mm-hmm. Ghiodati didn't have a delegation clause, so
right.
I think that's the first problem. The second is the factual issues, as Your Honor indicated, dealt directly with the arbitration agreement itself. Here, the factual issues go to the whole contract.
Well, I agree the delegation clause is important, but I focused on my question first because I really do think we're dealing with two entirely different categories of challenges. And the kind of challenge that's going on in this case goes to whether or not there's an agreement as a whole, using, of course, the argument based upon the Consumer Fraud Act and its violation. But nevertheless, it's still an argument as to whether you have an agreement as a whole, which seems to place it on an entirely different side of the ledger under Rent-A-Center and Buckeye. Buckeye seems to be directly dealing with that, particularly in the first footnote that Justice Scalia wrote, distinguishing these kinds of challenges and putting one separate from the other. We're dealing with no challenge to the arbitration agreement whatsoever, and, as you point out, the significance of a rather clear delegation clause that gives the issue of determining whether something falls within the arbitration provision and the contract to the arbitrator.
That's exactly our position, Your Honor.
So even if we were to view it otherwise, nevertheless, we're dealing with an extension of Ghiodati that doesn't even apply to this situation.
I would submit that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me give you a hypothetical. I'm going to help help me with this. Not this case. But assume a set of facts where an automobile, a dealership, or it could be some other merchant, slips an arbitration agreement before an unsuspecting consumer, suggests that the document is something other than an arbitration agreement, this, or a delegation clause, and the consumer signs it. And on that basis, the consumer challenges the signature on the arbitration agreement, which includes the delegation clause. Would you agree under those circumstances, based upon that assertion, under good, as long as there are conflicting claims, there would have to be a hearing to determine the truth of that?
Is Your Honor
following me?
Well, let me ask you, are you suggesting that the signature of the customer is
It's the customer's signature. No, it's the customer's signature, but the customer is asserting, okay, in response to a claim from the merchant, that I thought that was a different document. That's my signature. Didn't permit me to sign it. I signed it. The merchant told me that this was something else, and I signed it. Under those circumstances, would you say that it would have to be resolved in the style that Guidotti suggested?
No. And the reason I say that is because in Young versus Prudential, if a customer signs a contract, they're assumed to have read it and understood it when they signed it. And we go back to the delegation clause. If they had a delegation clause like they do in this case that talks about issues of negotiation of the contracts, and the validity.
So your position, from what I'm hearing, is as long as the signature there is on that piece of paper, that's the end of the matter. If it has a delegation clause, it goes to the arbitrator to determine arbitrability?
I believe it is, and I believe it has to be respectfully under contract law, because otherwise written contracts would have no effect.
The plaintiff can still win, but it would be winning before the arbitrator. The arbitrator can consider all of those,
right.
And that's Rent-A-Center as well.
Yes.
The arbitrator can consider all of those challenges, and the plaintiff may, in fact, win as a result of that.
And
it's just that the arbitrator makes the decision as to whether the challenge wins or not.
Yes, that's our position.
Then what was Guidotti talking about?
Guidotti was talking about the case where the plaintiff didn't sign the arbitration agreement, claimed that the arbitration agreement was not provided to her until after she signed all the contracts. So that's the factual, that's why Guidotti differs, I think, substantially from this case.
Guidotti was a challenge directly to the whether or not there was an agreement about the arbitration agreement.
Yes.
Not about the agreement
not about
as
the
a whole.
Agreement as a whole.
Right.
Yes.
I guess you would take the position that with no challenge to the specific challenge, in this case to the delegation clause, you need not go past Rent-A-Center here, but you have these additional arguments as well. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct.
There's something that's not central to this case I was hoping you could respond to that's of concern. The arbitration agreement has language toward the end that says buyers have only 6 months to bring a claim under the Consumer Fraud Act.
Yes.
Are you aware of the ruling in NAACP versus Folk Management Corporation from 2011, the published decision by the APTIV?
I am, and I was part of that case, and my understanding of the court's ruling in that case was because there were conflicting provisions related to the statute of limitations. That's why it was not enforceable. There was one document that said there is no limitation on the statute of limitations, and then there was another document that said it was limited to 180 days. And the court held, the appellate division held that the conflict in the languages nullified the waiver of the statute of limitations.
So let me read from you two passages from the case and then ask you a question. The appellate division referenced the document, the arbitration agreement, which restrictively required the purchaser to bring any claims, including claims under the Consumer Fraud Act, within 180 days from the date of the agreement. And then the APTIV said, quote, as the trial court correctly recognized, this provision is at odds with the 6-year statute of limitations generally applicable to CFA claims, and the trial court properly declined to enforce them.
And actually, that's a misstatement of what happened. The trial court actually did not, the trial court actually found that that provision was enforceable.
Sorry, found that the provision
that
was
enforceable, the statute of limitations, and I have the transcripts in my office.
So this seeming holding by the appellate division is mistaken, you're telling us?
I don't interpret it the way Your Honor does. I interpret the reason that the appellate division did not enforce the 180-day limitation is because there was language in other documents which conflicted it and said there was no statute of limitations. So that was my understanding of what the appellate division did.
So again, I don't want to belabor this. It's not the center of this case. But the active says trial court was right in noting that it was inappropriate to limit a six-year statute of limitations for the CFA to 6 months. As to that principle, did you read the case differently? Did you understand the APTIV's ruling to be different?
I did, because I know that what the trial court said was different from what the appellate divisions characterized.
What's your understanding about the appellate division's statement as to the propriety of a six-month limit on bringing CFA claims?
They didn't go into any analysis as to why a statute of limitations that was limited to 6 months would not be enforceable if it was reasonable. And that's what the Supreme Court, New Jersey Supreme Court, has said. Waivers of statute of limitations will be enforceable if they're reasonable. And there was no analysis. At the end of the opinion, if I recall correctly, in NWACP, the appellate division again went back to the analysis of the different provisions in the different documents. One document said there is no limitation on the statute of limitation, and another document said that it was limited to 6 months.
The agreements, this one is 5.5 years after the NAACP case. It still contains the 6 month. Is that the practice today as well?
I believe so.
And you believe that's consonant with the language of the appellate division ruling?
It's my understanding of the ruling, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I want to make certain I'm understanding this. You're saying that it is lawful to have in one of these agreements a truncated statute of limitations?
I believe under Mirror versus Holland, which has never been overruled, the appellate division previously held that consumer fraud statute of limitations could be reduced to 180 days. And this court has held that the analysis goes to the reasonableness of the reduction, the waiver of the statute of limitations.
Are you talking about the LAD ruling?
Justice McKay's opinion.
There's other case law that talks about, and I didn't realize that was going to be an issue addressed today, so I don't have the case at my fingertips. But there's cases from this court that say the analysis that goes into whether a statute of limitations is appropriate, a waiver of statute of limitations, a reduction, goes to whether it's reasonable, mm-hmm. whether the party could have realized their claim within the time of the reduction.
I'm thinking of the Ray Moore's case where we found an abbreviation of a statute of limitation period to be unreasonable because it interfered with other statutory policy objectives of
right.
the LAD.
And as I understood that opinion, it dealt with the New Jersey Law Against Discrimination, which had an administrative proceeding
yes.
that the Consumer Fraud Act does not have.
That was that setting, but yes, that you're correct in terms of Raymore's.
Right. And that's why I would submit to the court that I do not believe it applies to the Consumer Fraud Act, that it was seemed to be directly geared to claims under New Jersey Law Against Discrimination.
But can you cite us a case where we have blessed a shortening to 6 months of a CFA statute of limitations?
This court, no. The appellate division in Mira versus Holland did.
I'm sorry, what was the name of the case?
Mira, M-I-R-R-A versus Holland, H-O-L-L-A-N-D.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything you'd like to add to your argument?
Plaintiffs are alleging an ascertainable loss, correct? They're claiming that I didn't get my down payment until I got an attorney, correct?
Yes.
So let's, assuming that there's at least enough information that the ascertainable loss would go to a trier of fact, I want to bring you back to that regulation, the failure to give the contract. Assuming that there's an ascertainable loss, what remedies are available? And is one of them the right to completely nullify the entirety of the contract, everything?
Okay. I would submit that there is no specific allegation in the complaint or anywhere in this case that the plaintiff suffered an ascertainable loss causally related to the claim that they didn't get a copy of it. If I can think of one scenario where there may be an ascertainable loss, assuming that the contract, it was a sale of a car for a used car, and it had a used car warranty in it, and the customer didn't have the contract. The customer then takes the car to somebody else as opposed to back to the dealer, and then suffers, you know, pays for a warranty that otherwise would be covered. That would be an ascertainable loss causally related to not getting a copy of the contract. And there would...
But I'm looking, I want you to, they're at least alleging this. I'm looking at their complaint. They're alleging the down payment of $1,000 at the time of the filing of the complaint was not returned. Let's just assume, okay, that there is a contested, these facts are contested. And now go to the regulation, the failure to turn over a copy of the consumer agreement. What remedies are available?
It goes to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator has to determine what remedies are available. If the arbitrator determines that one of the remedies is an equitable remedy, that's within the arbitrator's purview.
They're not without a remedy. It's simply the forum where the remedy is
correct.
Adjudicated.
Right. So if the arbitrator were to determine that it's an equitable remedy and the contract's not enforceable, I think that's on the table. But it's not on the table before it goes to the arbitrator.
Except, we'll hear from them. They're alleging that particular regulation nullifies everything.
And we disagree.
Okay, got it.
And your point is, if that nullified arbitration agreements,
completely,
all that someone would need to do is say, I didn't get a copy, and if there were a fact dispute, the arbitration agreement would simply just go out the window.
Exactly. So we'd be in court in every single case, using judicial time and additional costs and expenses, and it would totally nullify what the purpose of the FAA is.
And your point also is that it's inconsistent with decided U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Borick.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, I'm going to focus on, I don't want to regurgitate the arguments made by petitioner. I'm focusing on, which I guess is the key issue in this case, the discrete issue of who decides this case. And I would say, and I would argue that this case, as has been stated before, falls directly within the parameters of Rent-A-Center. In this case, there is no dispute as to the validity of the arbitration agreement. And therefore, you know, it's our argument that the appellate division relied on Morgan, but misapplied Morgan and took it too far. And Morgan, this court had an issue with the actual arbitration agreement, finding that its nonconformance with Attlees ultimately affected the delegation clause as well, and therefore there was no formation of an arbitration agreement, and therefore that took it out of the Rent-A-Center holding. In this case, there's an allegation, and the appellate division found that there was a lack of formation based on an allegation that went to the underlying transaction, the whole contract, the whole transaction as a whole, which is a Consumer Fraud Act violation. And we're not here to argue that the plaintiffs don't get their day somewhere, that they don't get to go and argue that the Consumer Fraud Act nullified the agreement, that it is going to take it out of arbitration even. They still get to make that argument. But under, you know, precedent by the United States Supreme Court and Rent-A-Center, they have to take that argument to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator can send it back to court if that's...
The arbitrator, just to be clear, can find that the arbitration agreement is not valid and say, I'm stopping at the arbitrability determination under the delegation clause, and the rest of it goes back to court.
Correct.
And that's one of the remedies the arbitrator may impose.
Correct, Your Honor. So, in this court, and as Ms. Ricolo stated, Rent-A-Center specifically distinguished between challenges to the overall transaction and challenges to the arbitration agreement. And they found that because they found that Section 2 of the FAA affirmatively stated that arbitration agreements shall be valid without mention of the validity of the underlying transaction or contract documents that incorporated them. So by looking at the entire transaction and saying that allegations of Consumer Fraud Act allegations nullified or created an issue of a formation, they went beyond the what the holdings of Rent-A-Center and even this court in Morgan have dictated. Because, you know, as I said, Morgan really restricted the argument and looked at what the arbitration agreement held. You know, and again, I think that to take the appellate division's decision to its logical conclusion, we're dealing with a lot of mini trials within trials. You're going to be going back. You know, this plaintiff, for example, filed this case in 2016. We're still here determining what arbitration their claims will be held in. I don't even know if the Consumer Fraud Act contemplated this type of longevity you have this kind of fact-finding.
So play this out if you would. Let's say you are correct. It goes to the arbitrability decision goes to the arbitrator. Then the arbitrator finds, as a matter of fact, having heard conflicting testimony, finds more persuasive the plaintiff's position that they did not get the documents. What's the impact of that in arbitration?
They could send it back to court, and the arbitration is concluded, and then the plaintiffs continue with their litigation.
What about Consumer Fraud Act remedies?
In their Consumer Fraud Act remedies can be determined by either the arbitrator or the court, and I would argue that there's no difference. I think the arbitrator has the power to award any remedies equitable or within the statute that the court has the authority to.
You're saying that the arbitrator can say that based upon that statute that arbitration is a nullity and the case goes back to court.
Correct.
Is that consistent with Buckeye?
I think so, Your Honor.
Because in Buckeye, you had a similar challenge to an agreement as a whole, saying it was contrary to state statutory laws dealing with usurious practices. There was no challenge to the arbitration agreement itself, and the U.S. Supreme Court said it goes to arbitration. The arbitrator decides the question of whether or not there's a violation under the statute that renders the entire agreement invalid. But nevertheless, there was no challenge to the arbitration agreement. The arbitrator is the one who decides the underlying issue.
Correct, and I believe that it is consistent and consistent also with Rent-A-Center, which held very similarly that there was an allegation of unconscionability, which would possibly, if the plaintiff prevailed in that case as well, nullify the contract documents. However, it goes to the arbitrator to make that decision itself as an initial starting point.
And that that would require fact finding by someone.
By the arbitrator, correct, Your Honor.
By the arbitrator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Riley.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I am having a little trouble even with the hearing assist devices hearing you. And so if I can just ask that you speak just a little louder.
We'll do our best. Thank you.
I've always loved yelling
Sorry
at you,
Sorry about Riley. That. I got hearing aids on.
Mr. Riley, I've always loved yelling at you.
Say again,
I
sir?
I have always loved yelling at you.
Yes. Okay. Right. Yeah. A lot of things not working at this age, so hearing's one. One of the first things, there's been a lot of discussion about arbitrability and complying with Morgan. The plaintiffs in this case, if you look at their certifications, both indicated that they did not agree to the delegation of arbitrability or the arbitration agreement to the arbitrator. I argued these at both trial level in my trial briefs. I argued it. We put that in the appellate briefs. The claim that we did not challenge the delegation clause of the arbitration agreements is just factually incorrect. It's throughout the throughout that. So I just wanted to, because that is an issue. I'm very familiar with Morgan, having been amicus in that case, and I'm with the requirements, and I believe that the clients in this case, aside from the other contract defenses, have challenged arbitrability. Okay. And in addition to that, it's not Rent-A-Center that controls this, but one of the things on arbitrability is that first options, the Supreme Court in first options, said that contract defenses, mutual assent, is a defense to arbitrability, and that the court needs to, when you raise that defense as to arbitrability, it's the court, not the arbitrator, who decides that particular issue. I think that Judge Simandl and Judge Snyder, in their decisions in the Musso case, which is attached to the appendix in both of my cases, says this a lot better than I can express it. But first option controls this in that we have a contract defense, and that there was no mutual assent to arbitrability. I wanted to start off when I began this argument today was to talk about, there's a couple of issues here, which is the equipoise between arbitration and the Consumer Fraud Act. And in terms of the Consumer Fraud Act issues, this court in D'Agostino said, the CFA drafters expected the act to be flexible and adaptable enough to combat newly packaged forms of fraud and to be equal to the last machinations exploiting the vulnerable and unsophisticated consumer. By the way, if I didn't say it at the beginning, I meant to ask for reserve five minutes, and I'll try to finish this up. That's the factual situation in this case. This is not some technical violation that occurred with respect to these two young ladies who went into the dealerships and they had credit problems. They were the unsophisticated consumer that you're talking about. And this, not giving the contract to the two consumers, was not an aberration or some technical violation. It's part of the scheme that this particular defendant is involved in with spot delivery. There's been a lot said about spot delivery, the New Jersey Car. In fact, New Jersey Car should be on my side, on my client's side in this case, because the act is designed not just to protect the consumer, but it's designed to protect the honest merchant. Most car dealers are honest. So, but in this particular case, spot delivery by this defendant set up these two young ladies for two things. One was bait and switch, which actually occurred twice, a double bait and switch in the Goff case, first on the advertisement to sell her the car for $15,900. We didn't know until we got the contract document that they actually bumped it up to $16,900. And the second was when she came back thinking she had bought the car, had switched her insurance, taken the insurance off of the other car, brought back $750, which wasn't even in the contract documents, finds out that she can't buy the car. They try to switch her again, raising the price, and also asking her for more money, which would have increased the interest rate. So that's part of the scheme, and the fact that they don't give the contract documents is part of the scheme as well, because what it does is that the consumer doesn't know what they've signed. And that's the legislative purpose behind that.
Well, let me ask you, sir, what is the nature of your client, I'm sorry, and tell me if I'm not speaking loud enough. What is the nature of your client's challenge to the delegation provision? And my second question is, how, if at all, does that differ from their overall challenge that they didn't know what they were signing here?
Well, they did not agree to the arbitrator deciding arbitrability.
But is that simply that they challenged the entire arbitration agreement?
They challenged not only the arbitration agreement, right, but they specifically challenged that they had not agreed to an arbitrator hearing the issue of arbitrability.
And I'm sorry, Chief. And what is the basis for that challenge?
The basis for that challenge is the defendants asserting that they did not agree to it. And in the Robinson case...
No, well, your clients say they didn't agree to it.
The clients indicated they did not agree to it.
Okay.
Just as they said they didn't agree to the, in the Robinson case, they didn't agree to a contract at all. In Robinson, there was no enforceable contract because there's factual issues raised by Ms. Robinson.
But is it that
there's
the...
There's no Robinson argument right now.
Pardon?
There's no Robinson argument. I heard counsel say that Robinson is not included in the arbitration argument.
Johnson.
Oh, Johnson, I'm sorry, Johnson.
No, but I'm talking about Ms. Robinson. Ms. Robinson said that the documents that she was provided, or that she wound up signing, not provided.
So wait, they agree, let me just...
Those documents, okay, were contingent upon her mother signing the documents.
Okay.
And the documents themselves indicate that Mrs. Johnson was supposed to sign the documents. I think the appellate division...
So now we're getting to it. The basis for their entire challenge is that there was a signatory missing who was necessary in the Robinson case.
Well, and not only that the signature was missing, okay, but there had to be agreement from Ms. Johnson that she was going to go through with the deal.
Okay.
And including the arbitration agreement, including trading in the car, all of this was contingent, was part of the contingency when my client took the car under the idea that she would be able to bring the car back in 2 days and return it with no obligation.
Those challenges to the delegation clause were contained in...
I'm sorry.
Those challenges to the delegation clauses were contained in certifications
by
your
clients. Certifications, correct. Not only were they in the certifications, but the challenges that were in the trial briefs, they were argued before the trial court, and they were in the appellate briefs. That's why I'm just at a loss to understand why there's even any question about...
Okay, so one of the certifications that you're relying on, I'm looking at paragraph 11 of Ms.
Robinson's,
is the purchase was conditioned on both of us agreeing sign all the documents, including the arbitration agreement and its delegation of enforcement and arbitrability to the arbitrator, as well as having 2 days to decide if we wanted the
car. Correct. That's the Robinson certification.
That was the challenge in Robinson. I'm looking at paragraph 24. I did not agree to arbitration. I did not know what arbitration was. Did not agree to arbitrate or allow an arbitrator to decide any disputes, including the validity and enforcement of the arbitration. That's what you're relying on.
I'm relying on that. That's correct, Your Honor. And
so if you're relying on that, what's the next procedural step?
Am I too loud?
No.
Oh. The next procedural step is that in both of these cases, first of all, I think the Robinson case is easy as far as a factual dispute as to whether there was ever an enforceable contract, because of the fact that the documents themselves required, you know, the definition in the arbitration agreement in Robinson was Ms. Johnson and Ms. Robinson. They were the you that was contained therein. So on its face, this document indicates that it required, for the arbitration agreement to be binding, it required the signature of Mrs. Johnson.
Come to the Goff case, to move that argument to one side and just focus on Goff. What is left of an arbitration agreement then, if it's sufficient to come forward after and say, I didn't agree to arbitrate, I didn't know what arbitration meant, I have a right to go to court.
And they withheld the documents and didn't permit her to read the documents. That's also part of the allegation. And you have to look at the whole factual scheme here as to what was going on.
So is it your position that all a party to an arbitration has to do, even if they signed an arbitration agreement, is say they didn't give me the documents? It's I never got them. I never agreed to any of it. And then... arbitration's out of the picture.
I think you have to look at this case, Your Honor, on a case-by-case basis.
Understand, but...
Look at the... There's not just a naked assertion in either of these cases that they didn't agree or that they didn't get a copy. You have to look at the entire factual pattern here in terms of what was going on in the scam.
But it seemed to me that the heart of your argument is the failure that your clients allege to give them copies of the papers. That's right. That's the crux of the appellate division's decision, and that's very much the heart of your argument.
It was only part of the decision.
Were they right about that?
is it really enough?
To the argument, I'm sorry.
Is it really enough to invalidate an arbitration agreement and send everything to a court, notwithstanding a delegation clause, to simply say I didn't get a copy of the papers? I'm not saying anybody's truthful or untruthful, but does that really send it to court?
Well, I think that once those there's a factual dispute, and I'm saying to this court that it's not only the claim that they didn't get a copy, it's the claim that what was going on here was the full scam that evidences that there was a motive for these defendants not to provide copies to my clients so that they would not know what was going on. So you just can't look at, it's not a naked assertion. We have a certification from both of these clients that say under oath that they were not given copies. And you have that they did not agree to these contracts. You have in both cases that the contracts were canceled and that the language of the defendant's own documents say that if there's no financing approved, that there's no contract. And that was the first step in the appellate division decision, was to say in this case that there was the facts looked like there was actually no enforceable contract in Robinson because of the facts raised that it was all contingent upon Mrs. Johnson signing. But no matter that, the contract language itself says that it's canceled in the event, this is their language, by the way, that it's canceled.
But what about
the entire contract, including the arbitration clause?
What about Buckeye? Buckeye says that the arbitration provision survives the voiding of the underlying contract.
It doesn't survive the underlying contract under first options when there's a contract defense or a contract formation defense that requires factual finding. And that's the situation here, that you have a factual dispute that needs, and you know, the trial court gave short shrift to any argument that I made on a factual basis. In the Robinson case, the judge just disregared Adelies, NAACP versus Folk Morgan. Kernahan hadn't been decided at that point. But he just said, arbitration's arbitration. That's the preferred way.
Mr. Riley.
And in Goff, the trial judge said, let's assume everything you're saying is true. That everything you're saying is true. I'm not going to give you a hearing on these issues because of what they argued, the ancillary litigation. But that's no different than a red light, green light situation or any other contract formation defense. The trial judge in Goff recognized that I had raised a contract formation defense. But he said, I'm not going to give it to you. He said, it's not my pay grade. A higher pay grade is going to have to tell me I have to do that. And I'm asking this court, and I think that's really an important decision for this court, to make sure that with respect to enforcing Adelies and enforcing Morgan, I mean, in my view, the trial courts need to consider your decision.
One second.
You need to go back and instruct the trial courts that when these defenses are raised, these contract defenses are raised, that there's no mutual assent to the arbitration agreement and to arbitrability, and there's facts, as in this case, that support that. There's facts in this case that support that not only them,
Mr. Riley, I need to
ask clients.
I need to interrupt you for a second.
I'm sorry.
I want to do a housekeeping matter. They petitioned for cert. Our rules allow only the petitioner to get a chance at rebuttal. I checked, and I don't see a petition on your side, a cross petition. Am I correct?
No, there is no cross motion.
Okay, so give us your fulsome arguments, because we can't, under our approach, give you a rebuttal afterwards. So this is your.
Oh, okay.
Argument.
Yeah. Fine. Sorry. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I've already laid out for you that the appellate division, I believe, correctly said that there were no enforceable contracts. These contracts were canceled, and that as a result of the cancellation, that it put the parties back to square one, and the case law from this court has said that you can't partially, try to enforce part of a contract when the entire contract has been canceled unless there's an agreement otherwise. And this defendant, with the skilled counsel it has, clearly knows how to write an arbitration agreement that would survive the transaction, and they have not done that.
The arbitration agreement, at least as it's written, satisfies Adelise and Morgan. It advises, assuming your client read it, okay, it advises the client that arbitration means something other than going to court, right to trial by jury, and there also is a clear and unmistakable delegation clause. Would you concede at least that?
I did not challenge the language in the arbitration clause because it's part of an integrated document.
Right. So that takes this case outside of Adelise, because that's what Adelise was talking about. Are you asking for this case to be given a Guidotti hearing? Is that what you're asking?
Absolutely, I'm asking for. I asked for a Guidotti hearing. I think that I've raised enough factual issues that this needs to go back to the trial court.
And that's based upon the certifications that you submitted to the trial court. You're claiming the judge should not have summarily sent this case to arbitration. He should have made factual findings. Is that your argument?
Before that ever gets sent, the court needs to be able to send this to have a fact finder, and in this case, it would be...
So I'm just trying to understand your argument. Your position is the trial court should have conducted some sort of hearing, and the judge could have determined that the certifications that your client gave were not credible. He could have done that.
It would be a fact finder, and I don't
right.
If your argument's accurate, Mr. Riley.
Because saying Guidotti says Guidotti is no different than the summary judgment motion under our rules.
Right.
It's the same thing. I've raised factual issues, substantial factual issues, as to arbitrability, to whether there was ever any agreement in these cases.
Mr. Riley, if your argument's right, would that nullify every delegation agreement? Because if you raise issues of fact and it goes to the trial court at all times to determine whether it should go to arbitration or not, the delegation clause of our contract would be nullified at all times under your argument, would it not?
There has to be a factual decision at the trial level that
come back to the
center. Agreed to arbitration. I'm just trying to hear better. Yeah.
Want to catch you on video. Go ahead.
Now you're on.
I'm sure the microphone can pick me up. Sorry.
I'm trying to understand your argument. Your argument, if I understand it, is that the judge should determine the credibility of your client's certification. If the judge found that your client's allegations were not credible, then the delegation clause would come into play.
Correct, but I want to be clear. I don't think it's the judge that decides a contract defense. The judge in Goff pointed out that it's a standard contract formation issue, and it would probably go to the jury.
So you're saying you get a jury out of this. You don't want the trial court deciding this.
You don't want an arbitrator. It's no different than summary judgment. So you would have defendant would make a summary judgment motion. The plaintiffs would challenge that if the judge finds that there's a material issue of fact, that there's a dispute as to whether or not my clients agreed to arbitration, whether they agreed to arbitrability, then that's nothing but part of the whole case.
You said earlier as well that your clients, agreed to cancel the contract. What are you relying on as proof of that?
Well, first of all, Ms. Robinson went back and said, I don't want the car. Give me my money back. Give me my car back. And what happened was, they initially, as the court knows, they held on to the car. That's called dehorsing in the automobile vernacular. It means they take the person out of his car, so what am I going to do? How do I get home? How do I do it? So she canceled. She and her mother said, we don't want the car. It was done. They finally, after they threatened to call the police, they gave them back the car, but they held on to the money because the money's control. Because if I have, and that's where the honest version comes in, if I had their money, they can't go out and buy another car somewhere, so you're stuck. So they finally gave the money back after we filed suit. Is there any question that the contract is canceled?
So there's the contract for the purchase and sale, and there's a separate contract for the arbitration agreement. What I'm asking is, what were you relying on to say that they rescinded the arbitration agreement?
The defendant's own documents make it absolutely clear that the arbitration agreement is part of an integrated contract, including the retail order, including the spot delivery document. It's all together. And both the arbitration agreement and the motor vehicle retail order say that. So it's the defendant's own documents that say this is an integrated contract and the deal is canceled. They could have said that this is a separate arbitration agreement that survives any cancellation of the contract or continues on. As a matter of fact, they're doing that now. But not in this case. As this court said in Harris versus Delta Funding, you got to look at the contract documents from the consumer's perspective. So if you look at these if you read these documents and you look at the ambiguities that are there, the transaction is canceled. And the appellate division correctly said that it's done, and they cited cases that I didn't cite that with respect to the fact that once the deal is over, they're back to square one. They can't just enforce part of it.
There's Supreme Court case law that speaks to the severability of arbitration clauses, arbitration agreements. Is your argument consistent with that law? It sounds as though you're flipping it around to say they're only severable if they say so.
Exactly. I'm not discussing the severability. I'm saying that the documents from this defendant made the arbitration agreement part of the integrated contract so that the entire order, including the arbitration agreement, was canceled once both of these parties agreed to do so, and in both cases, they agreed to do so. And in fact, in the Goff case, it was the defendant that canceled the contract and said, took the car back and said, we're taking it back unless you pay more money. So, without getting into that Supreme Court case on severability, they need to include the language that it's severable, and that's not included in any of these documents. It actually says it's not severable based on the defendant's language.
Your adversary has said that there's no ascertainable loss and therefore you're not entitled to equitable relief. Do you want to respond to that?
I again refer you to D'Agostino. And in D'Agostino, you recall in D'Agostino there was a equitable remedy and a ascertainable loss. In D'Agostino, you said that the CFA contemplates imposing equitable relief as a part of a broad statutory remedy. And 5.8:2-19, which talks about ascertainable loss, also talks about equitable remedies. And D'Agostino said that these are non-exclusive. So the court, in this particular situation, can fashion an equitable remedy, but we've already alleged an ascertainable loss. There is an ascertainable loss in both of these cases. And I submit to you that because holding on to the copies of the documents was part of the scheme in this case to defraud these plaintiffs, that there's even a causal connection between failing to give the copy and their ascertainable loss, although I don't think you need that under this court's, both the statute and this court's interpretation that an equitable remedy is certainly part of the broader scheme of the CFA.
Anything else you'd like to add?
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come back and argue these cases, Your Honor.
Mr. Osefchin.
May it please the court, As may have been clear from the amicus brief filed by the NAACP, one of the issues that organization is interested in is the consequences, and Justice Albin has been asking questions about it, the consequences of what happens when there is a violation of 56:8-2.22. I've heard the defendant say, first in front of the appellate division and here, that the remedy for violating that statute, and this is a statute, this is not a regulation, this is passed by the legislature, signed by the government, as far as it goes, that is the real deal. That is the public policy of New Jersey. That there's no ascertainable loss, and I wrote down the quote, and if I didn't write fast enough, I apologize. What defense counsel said was there's no ascertainable loss causally related to the failure to provide a copy of a document. I'm not sure that that's an incorrect statement, because I have a hard time coming up with a hypothetical where there's an ascertainable loss flowing merely from the fact that they didn't give you a copy of the contract. And yet the statute still exists, saying that the remedy is you're going to sue in court for money for treble damages is completely illusory when the defendant themselves are asserting that there's no possible ascertainable loss from violating. So what you have is a statute where there is no meaningful remedy for violating it. And I submit that if there's no remedy, there's no rule. We have posted speed limits to say 55. We enforce that by saying if you go 75, you're going to get a ticket. If we posted a speed limit of 55, but we didn't do anything when somebody went 75, I submit there would be no speed limit.
Is that issue before the court? Isn't the question here whether the court or the arbitrator will ultimately make a determination on the merits of the claim?
Only assuming that there's a valid arbitration clause.
There's obviously a lot of different issues that are floating around about the question of arbitrability. My question for you is the question what the proper remedy is under Section 22, even before the court at this juncture?
Well, Your Honor, it certainly was one of the things that the appellate division hung its hat on, and I would urge the court to say that it is, because it gets to the question here, from my peculiar point of view. We have a situation, and Mr. Riley, I think, covered it, but I'll cover it again. We're not dealing with a situation where somebody just wanders in and says, oh, they didn't give me a copy of the documents. Mr. Riley, considering the fact that he was completely deprived of any opportunity to take discovery, managed to put together a pretty good factual record. He's got certifications in there, not just from Ms. Goff and Ms. Robinson, but from other people who are unrelated to them, saying that Folk Management dealerships failed to give them copies of the contract. There's enough evidence in there without discovery, I think, to make a prima facie case.
Is that a custom and habit argument, counsel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is that a custom and habit argument that you make, other people's unrelated, he made, that they didn't receive it? Is that the argument?
It's an argument that there's evidence of a policy that this is not some situation where a plaintiff who wants to get out of a deal comes into court and says, I didn't get a copy of a document. I show five people did the same, have the same
in
thing.
Your mind, it's admissible under rules of evidence in support of a motion? Certification from other people and related to this case that they also didn't get documents and another card purchase?
I think it could be evidence of a policy, yes. I don't see how it could be. That's how you prove a policy.
Can you give me the rule of evidence that would allow that?
I don't understand the question, obviously, Ron.
It has to be fall under some rule of evidence.
In police misconduct cases, I prove deliberate indifference by showing they did the same thing to other people. Those things get into evidence. I've litigated police.
Since you were talking about speed limits, could you bring proof into a case that the defendant ran several stop signs on all the days and therefore he has a habit of running stop signs in this particular case?
No, I don't think that has anything to do with what we're talking about. We're talking about the defendant deliberately pursuing a policy of failing to give contract documents in direct violation of the Consumer Fraud Act, which says that he has to.
And you believe that would be admissible for the court to determine based on that?
I think that the court could find that there's a policy, yes. I don't understand how I prove a policy otherwise, other than forcing the defendant to admit to the policy, you show that they do the same thing.
That would be one way.
Well, I suppose it would be relevant if if the dealership was claiming that this on one occasion occurred by accident.
Exactly. That, and the purpose of what I was saying was to show that it's not an accident. It's not a situation where one plaintiff coming in and lying. The allegation is that it is a policy. However we prove it.
But if all that's true, the decision as to what impact it has on an outcome, whether there's damage, whether there's not damage, whether there's a violation of the act, not a violation of the act, is determined by either an arbitrator if the clause is valid, or a court if it's not, right? One way or the other, it's going to be decided by one.
Yes.
And so the only issue, I think what Justice Patterson's trying to get at, is the only issue here is who decides it.
Exactly.
So why are you arguing about what the decision is when you ought to be arguing about who decides it?
And I'm trying to get there in my five minutes. Let's assume that I had a perfectly drafted, Attlees compliant, pre-printed contract of adhesion that delegated clearly and unmistakably arbitrability to the arbitrator. And my client says, they pulled out a gun and told me, sign that. Now, if I understand the defendant correctly in some of the comments I've heard, because the clause is unmistakably clear, the arbitrator would get to decide whether or not that contract was signed based on pointing a gun at them.
And the arbitrator would then hear from your client in that hypothetical
But then we'd
situation.
Be assuming that there was a meeting of the minds and not that there was a contract formed. I obviously am not getting all the...
You're going back to the language in the FAA that still reposes in courts to determine under law or equity whether or not there was a contract.
My understanding of Attlees, and maybe it's my unique understanding of Attlees, is that the foundation of it is not about which magic language you put in your contract, but rather giving life to the part of the FAA that says arbitration contracts are contracts. And regular old contract rules apply. That we don't discriminate against arbitration contracts, but you still have to have a meeting of the minds.
So in a situation like that, is it enough if you have a signed contract to come forward and say, I didn't agree to arbitrate, and I don't know what arbitration is? Very different scenario than your hypothetical.
I don't think so. I don't remember who it was. It might have been Justice Brennan. Somebody said that the Supreme Court is not infallible because they're final. They're final, but no, it's the other way around.
He just spoke for that Supreme Court.
Wow. So I am bound by Attlees, and I accept Attlees to refute what Your Honor's hypothetical was. I don't think I could come into court and argue that a clearly worded clause, my client just didn't understand it. Because that would put me at odds with the Supreme Court, in which case I'd obviously be wrong.
So what puts you over the top here? As to the Goff matter, the fact that
is that there is a statute that governs how these type of contracts are supposed to be formed. I'm supposed to get it signed, yes, but I'm supposed to give them a copy. There's a statute that says so. I think that describes how consumer contracts in writing are supposed to be formed in New Jersey, and that the failure to do that means that there was no contract.
Now, where do you get that?
Why is that different from Buckeye? Buckeye said that a contract could be criminally against the policy of the state of Florida if they had interest rates that were in violation of their statute. And that attack on the overall validity of the contract was not sufficient to get around a clearly written delegation clause in an arbitration agreement.
I don't understand how there could be an enforceable arbitration agreement if there was no contract at all.
Because the United States Supreme Court has distinguished between attacks on the overall agreement and whether or not there is an overall agreement or contract between the parties, and specific challenges to whether there's an agreement to arbitrate. That's what appears to me in this whole line of cases.
But how can there be an enforceable contract to arbitrate if there's no contract at all?
You're supposed to tell us that. You're supposed to tell us that.
I, I understand. And I guess when I was asked to represent the NAACP, when I heard what had happened in this case, I thought, isn't it ironic that a defendant where the alleged contract ab initio was formed in violation of our statute saying how a contract's supposed to be formed is now raising that contract in a court and saying this contract, which was formed ab initio in a violation of the statute, now protects me.
All the statute says that it's an unlawful practice not to give a copy. That's what it says. Doesn't say what the remedy is.
Exactly.
It?
The
remedy may not be voiding the contract. There may be some other remedy. No?
Other than...
There could be a fine. There could be...
Other than equitable... I've never seen a layperson get a fine under the consumer fraud. The Attorney General, I suppose, could get that remedy.
Well, just an example. The Consumer Fraud Act requires certain specifications for home remodeling contracts. Just to give an example, the number of the contractor has to be at a certain point.
Exactly.
And sometimes contractors have forms that don't have their number on it. Just use that example. Those contracts are not invalidated, are they? There may be a CFA claim.
The failure to list the number, but certainly Huffmaster and its progeny there have been instances where, for example, a contractor has failed to give a written contract. There's nothing in common law.
Different. I'm talking about a technical violation of the CFA.
I understand.
Not a lack of contract, but a technical violation of the CFA, which I think is probably analogous to this
but,
section.
But there's nothing in common law contract that says a home improvement contract has to be in writing. That comes exclusively from the Consumer Fraud Act. There's no requirement that the contract be in writing.
There may not just be one remedy. You know, what if at the moment of the transaction a copy was not given, but it was given 6 hours later or 12 hours later or the next day? Do you think the same remedy
there's
would apply?
There's no time limit in it, Your Honor, other than I understood it to be from the language to be contemporaneous. But it's undisputed that did not happen here.
But are you claiming that if it's not given at the moment of the transaction, even if it's given 60 minutes later, that the contract is void? I'm trying to understand your interpretation of the statute.
No, Your Honor, I don't think I'm claiming that, though I'm at this point separated from my copy of the statute. My understanding, the statute says it's an unlawful practice to either require or request that a document be signed without providing them with a copy. Now, does it say that it absolutely has to be contemporaneous? Without looking at the statute, I got to admit that I haven't put a lot of thought thinking about that issue.
You would agree that not every unlawful practice under the Consumer Fraud Act would invalidate the contract?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So then tell us precisely what it is about 2.22.
Because it is enshrined. It's not a regulation that was promulgated by a regulatory body or the Attorney General. It's part of the statute itself, and it says what has to happen. I don't think anybody can read that without thinking they're supposed to give a copy of the contract
to
people who sign it.
That's fair that you've got to give a copy of the contract. How do you get to the next?
Well, I tried to before. The Huffmaster and its progeny say that when a vendor failed to put their home improvement contract in writing as required by the CFA, they cannot go into court and then enforce that illegally formed contract. I think that it's a natural extension that what I'm arguing, that they also should not be able to enforce this contract because, as I said, I think it sets forth a rule for what is required to even form a consumer contract in New Jersey. It doesn't discriminate against arbitration clauses. 56:8-2.22 applies to every contract. It doesn't discriminate. It doesn't violate the FAA, then, in my opinion, to say you got to do that. What if the legislature passed a statute that said every contract in New Jersey had to be witnessed? And here's a defendant shows up with an unwitnessed contract, says it has an arbitration clause. Please enforce it. Don't let them sue me. I would be making the exact same argument, I suppose, though I think that this is a much more important requirement than my hypothetical all contracts have to be witnessed. because there are real consequences when you give unsophisticated people copies of the contract they signed.
So we're just about at the five-minute mark.
All right, then. Let me look if there's anything else. I do know, and it is an unreported opinion, but in the 2010 case in Patella, the appellate division raised this issue and then refused to decide it. I argued the appellate division below to please decide the issue of whether or not the court is going to adopt my argument that a failure to comply with this statute means that the contract ab initio is a nullity, however it decides it, people like me will stop asking the court to do it once there's a clear decision on it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wright. And you are certainly welcome to incorporate prior arguments as you make your presentation.
May it please the court, my 5 minutes may be shorter than Mr. Josephson's.
Try to keep your voice up. Thanks.
Sure. This case is about contract defenses, contract formation, and interestingly, we just hit on it, the continued viability of Skebec. And I asked the question in...
the continued viability of what?
Skebec. That's the Skebec versus Longuette case that says a contractor who violates the act can't enforce the terms of his contract. And that goes to the very question that I asked in our brief, which is, does allowing a merchant, a contractor, to enforce a contract in the face of an unlawful practice strip the act of the gravitas intended by the legislature? 2.22 was enacted with a purpose. It was enacted to ensure that people could keep good records, people could know and enforce their rights. These are the things that underlie the Skebec case. These are the things that underlie the defense when we say a contract was formed in violation of the statute. The person who drafted that contract shouldn't be able to enforce their rights. And then we get into my discussion in the brief about quantum merit to address Justice Patterson's question before about contractors and the number being in there. There is a remedy. This isn't going to result in what the car dealers would have you believe, in people walking out with free cars merely because they said, I didn't get a copy, here's my car, I'm leaving, see you later, and they take it and drive off and the rest is history. These questions about arbitrability, but really we'd be making these same arguments if the contract here was arbitration contract, a sales contract. It just so happens that we're here because one of the provisions here is an arbitration contract. So how do we deal with the FAA? Guidotti gets it right. When someone raises a serious and a real issue of fact, that has to go through the Guidotti procedure. And the issue of fact is, and Guidotti said it, and it's in the Parnett Mills case, Parnett Mills versus Stockbridge, an unequivocal denial of the agreement to arbitrate accompanied by supporting affidavits is sufficient to remove it from the, in the federal court, it was the 12B6 standard, but to bring it into the Guidotti procedure.
Let me see if I understand your argument. The factual dispute that you believe under Guidotti must be decided is whether or not the documents were actually given to the consumers. And your legal argument is that a violation of 2.22 automatically means that there was no formation of a contract, any contract, arbitration agreement, arbitrability agreement, or any of the other agreements that were embedded in this contract. Is that basically what you're arguing?
Correct, and though that specific statutory section wasn't at issue in Skebec versus Longuette, that's essentially what the appellate division said there. A contract, a merchant who violates the act should not benefit from the terms of the contract.
But was that not, that was not about arbitrability?
Skebec was not, no.
No, and that's important because the FAA comes into play and Buckeye comes into play in a case in which the issue is arbitrability, whereas
if the question was just a general contract and people's respective rights, the U.S. Supreme Court would have very little say about it. Would you agree with me about that?
I agree, and that's where the Guidotti procedure steps in the middle.
Hold on a second, because what you're saying is that this contract, this as soon as this contract comes into play and there's a dispute about whether or not there was a violation of the CFA section, then you have a procedure before a court. And what you were saying in so many words is there is no arbitrator involved in that under Guidotti, and you were therefore saying that arbitration is off the table, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, now let's how does that law, which you are citing, come into play when we hear from the U.S. Supreme Court that in the Buckeye case, that when you have a voidable contract, the arbitrability provisions survive whatever happens to that contract under state law?
So, in this case, and going back to the appendix again, the appendix with that actually contains the arbitration agreements at issue in this case. The agreements are not necessarily a provision built into a bigger picture contract. It appears to be, and Ms. Ruccolo held up the big giant copy of it, a standalone document, arguably a standalone contract,
so,
which was not provided to the consumer in accordance with 2.22, and therefore that standalone contract, if it's not an integrated provision severable under Buckeye and under Rent-A-Center, standing alone, it was not provided to the consumer, whatever type of contract.
You say that's just invalidated under
invalidated by virtue of state contract law.
Okay, and that the FAA has nothing to say about it. That's your position.
Well, the FAA, to reconcile the FAA with fact issues related to state contract law, that Judge Johnson in the Third Circuit created the Guidotti procedure, where he said, essentially, it's a good time to pump the brakes on the FAA's speed impulse. If there is a genuine issue, this is not a naked assertion. We wouldn't be here if this was a naked assertion of somebody simply saying, hey, I didn't get a copy. We have sworn statements. We have other facts surrounding those sworn statements and set forth in those sworn statements that raise genuine issues.
Why shouldn't you read Buckeye to say that fight can happen. That dispute can be resolved, but it must be resolved initially by the arbitrator. The arbitrator may make a determination that the contract is tossed out. But why isn't Buckeye saying to us that in the first instance that goes to the arbitrator?
Because there are two types of gateway questions, and this is in the Rent-A-Center case when they go through and analyze how Buckeye decides these. The two types of gateway questions are validity. There are procedural and substantive, so there are questions about validity, the terms of the agreement, whether it's at least compliant, statutes of limitations, timelines, deadlines. The other type of gateway question that the parties would typically expect the court to decide is, did parties conclude an agreement to arbitrate in the first instance?
Rent-A-Center dealt with the gateway question of arbitrability and the delegation of that issue to the arbitrator.
But not necessarily whether...
If you're talking about Rent-A-Center and not some other case.
Not necessarily whether the parties concluded the agreement to arbitrate. It dealt with the validity. It dealt with the unconscionability of the terms of the agreement. But not at the outset, the concluding of an agreement to arbitrate.
But the failure to give the document isn't necessarily inconsistent with the fact that there was an agreement. This, I guess, goes to the question of whether there was a formation or whether it's voidable afterwards, correct?
Exactly. If the legislature intended...
No, but I'm saying, isn't it not possible that it was formed, but under this regulation, the fact that it wasn't given just means it's voidable.
Voidable, as opposed to void ab initio.
Yeah. There was a contract. There was a meeting of the minds. But under our state statute, if you do not turn over that document, that agreement is void. It's voidable. This goes back to what Justice Patterson was saying. Are you following me?
I'm following you, and there's an argument to be made for that. But because of what other challenges we have in the facts of this specific case and the facts of other cases that could come up, that's where the Guidotti procedure would step in and say, we have a genuine issue.
I don't see that. Take Goff. I don't see that much more than the failure to receive a contract and a certification that says, I didn't agree, and I don't know what arbitration is. That's not much more than simple failure to receive a copy.
And under the Parnett Mills case, a raising of these facts with accompanying sworn statements like that, it's not a naked assertion.
I'm not getting to whether it's naked or fully clothed. I'm getting to how much is there.
And that may ultimately result in prompt disposition on summary judgment, but it shouldn't bar discovery on these genuine issues.
So this is one of the things I'm struggling with, too, and it's been raised. Forget about a delegation clause. This is talk with a strict arbitration clause that has all the bells, whistles, signals, and more than we required in Attlees, such as the arbitration agreement here. It has a lot. And the consumer just comes in, yeah, I signed it, I read it, I just didn't understand it. Is there going to be a need for a hearing under those circumstances?
Well, that's a different issue, and I forget the name of the case off the top of my head, but that says asserting a lack of understanding of a contract or a lack of reading of a contract isn't a defense to its formation. That's a slightly different issue, and I think that may lend itself. If the clause is at least compliant, that may lend itself to dismissal under the 12b-6 or the motion to dismiss standard. But that's not what we're talking about with the Guidotti procedure. The Guidotti procedure would see something more and something substantive to at least warrant interrogatories document production.
Can you tell me if Guidotti is followed in any other circuit?
In any other circuit?
Yeah.
I don't believe it is.
Thanks.
Mr. Wright, anything else?
No. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. Mr. Cole, brief rebuttal.
I want to address the argument that NJSA 56.8-2.2 says that if a contract isn't given to a consumer, it's not formed. This court interprets statutes by the plain language. There's nothing in the plain language of that statute that says if the consumer doesn't get a copy, there's no contract formed.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Your adversary, Mr. Riley, said that he raised the delegation, the challenge to the delegation clause sufficiently under Rent-A-Center. Why is he wrong?
He is wrong. He's wrong because the facts that he raised don't go to the delegation clause. He's never asserted and he's never attacked, which is what Rent-A-Center requires, that the delegation clause is not clear and conspicuous. And that's the same standard that this court adopted, that a delegation clause is only attacked when the attack goes to whether it's clear and conspicuous. All of the facts that he claims the plaintiffs are attacking the delegation clause upon go to the contract as a whole.
What I was hearing from him, I think, was I raised challenges to the entire agreement, and I specifically mentioned the delegation clause. I was trying to go back to the certifications here to see if that was so, but let's assume it is. Let's assume a plaintiff in his client's situation says, I've attacked the entire, every single word of that document I say was invalid for lack of clarity or something along those lines. Is that enough under Rent-A-Center?
He didn't do it in this case. if he attacks, Rent-A-Center says you have to specifically attack the delegation clause on the basis that it's not clear and conspicuous. So I think Rent-A-Center is very clear what the standard is.
Well, what if, I have the certification here. Forget about clear and conspicuous. He's saying, I never agreed to a delegation clause. I'll just read you the sentence. And you tell me whether or not this is not at least a specific challenge to a delegation clause. The purchase was conditioned on, this is Robinson's, the purchase was conditioned on both of us agreeing, sign all the documents, including the arbitration agreement and its delegation of enforcement and arbitrability to the arbitrator, as well as having 2 days decided to want the car. She is saying that the precondition necessary for this arbitrability agreement to kick in never occurred.
So the precondition we dispute.
No, so I understand that. That's what they're arguing should be decided in this Guidotti hearing, the very thing you're disputing now.
But his, if you read that, reading that language is really a dispute to the whole contract. It's, I didn't read the contract, I didn't know I was agreeing to arbitration, I didn't agree to the delegation clause.
You're saying that what Rent-A-Center requires is a specific attack on the language of the delegation clause as removed from the rest of the contract.
Exactly, yes.
And then if even if the delegation clause is mentioned as a component of a bigger contract, that either to arbitrate or even broader to the underlying contract, that's not enough.
That's not enough. The Rent-A-Center says the plaintiff has to attack the delegation clause based on whether it's clear and conspicuous.
Well, that was the factual scenario in which that case arose. Are you telling me that an arbitrability agreement would be enforceable if there was no signature on the agreement?
I'm not telling you that. And that's
why not? Reason, why not?
And that's the reason we're not challenging Johnson, because Johnson didn't sign it. So we're not challenging that. But you have a signature on these contracts.
Okay. But she's claiming that there had to be two signatures, that this doesn't go into effect unless there... That's at least her argument. I'm not saying it's a winning argument. That's her argument.
And under Young versus... under Film Life and the cases on parole evidence, if a contract is clear on its face, there's no requirement in this contract that says Johnson has to sign this or it's not enforceable. In fact...
You're saying it's enforceable against Robinson.
Yes, we're saying it's enforceable against Robinson. At the bottom, where Johnson signed, it says, I, as the undersigned, hereby acknowledge that the attached conditional sales release contracts were fully completed and explained to me prior to my fixing my signature on the contract. I immediately received a copy of the contracts along with the arbitration agreement and acknowledge that I fully understand the contents therein. So there's nothing in this contract that supports their interpretation that it was contingent. They use the word contingent. There's nothing in this contract that says it's contingent upon Johnson signing it. And that's, they can make that argument, but they get the arbitrator make it.
Anything else you want to add? Try to, because we're beyond the five already.
I'm good, thank you.
Thank you.